איך מכניסים מפתח חדש לפרויקט? כדי לענות לשאלה הזאת, הזמנתי לרעיון עבודה את תום אחידרור ואת טים פוסט. הרעיון הזה יהיה באנגלית.
רעיון עבודה. רעיונות מעשיים מפי מנהלים, חוקרים ומומחים בתחומם. עורך ומגיש, חוקר הנתונים, דוקטור בוריס גורליק. בואו נתחיל.
Tom Achidror is a co-founder at Swin. He was the VP of Business Development in ITC, a super cool project that brings young Jewish professionals to Israel for internship. He also worked as the head of human capital in the Israeli National Cyber Directorate. Tom holds a degree in math and physics from the Hebrew University, MBA from Tel Aviv University, and a master of public policy from Princeton. Tim Post is the head of developer relationships at Swim. He worked for 7 years at different positions at Stack Overflow, the company that just changed the world. Tim studied computer science and criminal justice at the Catonsville Community College.
Did it pronounce it okay? That was perfect.
Okay, thank you. So this is my introduction. How did I do?
Perfect.
You did well. The only thing I would add about myself is that I'm a Talpiot graduate, not to boast, just because I'm proud of it and, you know, it's part of my identity. Yeah. But that's it, yeah.
Yeah, so Talpiot, for those who don't know, is just a bunch of super smart nerds who wear army uniform and study math and physics.
I'm definitely a nerd.
Yeah. So before we continue, I have to ask Tim. So, computer science and criminal justice. I mean, today when we had some scandals about using machine learning in criminal justice, it's like the connection is pretty much obvious. But how come you decided to learn it like in 1991?
Well, it was at the time that I went to school, I didn't really have a clear path ahead of me in technology. I had a desire for it. I knew how to program. I was running a dial-up BBS business with a bunch of lines going into it. And I knew C and I knew a lot of good stuff, but it didn't feel like it was ever going to translate to anything but a sort of expensive hobby at the time. I mean, long distance modem calls weren't cheap, you know, So when I went, I had a dual major. And what my strategy was is I could take the computer science stuff because that came very naturally to me. And at the time, the curriculum for CS was very basic. Literally, they taught basic. So that was like my easy credits. That was the stuff that I could count on to keep my GPA reasonably high while I really delved into something that fascinated me, which is criminal justice and the idea of community policing that was going on at the time, which is why I went to that. I didn't know.
I suppose today it would be a complete opposite. The people would take computer science like the hard major to just to make for a living, and criminal justice just, you know, to do something interesting.
Well, it just goes to show you how much your perspective can completely change, you know, your reality versus someone else's. Right. To me, the computer science stuff was just stuff that I had accumulated naturally over. I mean, I was, I think, 7 or 8 years old when I typed my first basic program into a TRS-80. So it was, you know, quite natural for me. It's something that I always had with me. Where the criminal justice stuff was, there was a lot I needed to learn. There was a lot of psychology going on there. There was a lot of bureaucracy and government and things like that that you had to learn in order to be successful in that field. So I just decided that computer science was my safe thing and I was going to go for computer for criminal justice. And then the first dot-com boom happened and that completely blew up every plan that I had, which is often the case with plans. So I ended up going with not really even the computer science, but just as a person that knew how Unix worked. And could operate in that environment, yeah. I was extremely valuable. And I was poached right out of college into the first dot-com boom.
So we are surrounded by two nerds. And I think at this point, we can start the real interview.
We have established nerdity.
So, yeah.
אל תשכחו להירשם לפודקאסט השני שלי השבוע במזרח התיכון, אותו אני מוציא יחד עם המזרחן, דוקטור ירון פרידמן.
So hello again. We are talking about onboarding, and this is the first time that in my podcast, at least, that I'm talking about a topic with a person or two persons here that represent a company that works on this specific topic. So just to make sure, you guys don't pay me. I don't have any interest in your success, except you look like nice guys and I wish success to everybody. Tom and I, so we met virtually because I tried to sell my services as a freelancer to Swim, but it didn't go well. But yeah, so this is the disclaimer. And after we are done with the disclaimer, please tell me, you know what? So you are trying to solve the problem of onboarding. So you have a new engineer and they just go and start engineering or start programming. What's the problem with that?
So before we get into that, I'll just say that we did start with trying to solve the problem of engineer onboarding specifically, mm-hmm. but we stumbled upon something that we realized is a much more much deeper problem, and that is the problem of documentation. And that's not the issue at hand of this podcast, but that's what we do, and onboarding is a very important part of that. Because lack of documentation usually is the situation, and that affects onboarding significantly. And your question was, what is onboarding?
What is onboarding is pretty much obvious, but why it is a problem? How big the problem is?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure it's obvious. I'll explain why. When we were researching before starting Swim, we were talking with a lot of development managers, engineering managers, and we asked them, how much time does it take until someone is fully ramped up? That was the question we asked a lot. And usually the answer was, well, it takes a few days or a few weeks until someone starts to deliver value, which is weird because that's not what we asked, right? We asked, how much time does it take until someone is fully ramped up? Right. And I think the reason they answered a different question is because they never really asked themselves that question. So it's pretty easy for managers to understand, to realize when someone is starting to deliver because they see code that's being pushed, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a bit harder to think about how much time it takes until they're like a regular part of the team.
I think that maybe they didn't ask this question because everybody gave up on measuring this, because I mean there are some legends about measuring lines of codes like back in the 90s or 80s even, but after that everybody realized that measuring lines of code is meaningless. And nobody could find any other good metric. So if there is no metric, why should we? It's like measuring the happiness.
You're right. And we also think that measuring that is very complicated, and maybe it's not even possible. However, thinking about it is extremely important. And mm-hmm. I'll explain why. So when you ask managers how much time it takes to ramp up, and following their first answer, you say, well, yeah, but how much time does it take until someone is like fully ramped up? They usually know what answer to give. It's intuitive, right? And we found that most will say that it's between 3 and 9 months, which is a lot. And in some cases, it's a year. And that's a lot of time, particularly when you think about the tenure of most people in companies, in software teams today, which can be less than 2 years. And if that is the case, you might have a bunch of people working for you, and half of those or like a third of those are not fully ramped up. And that's a very big number. And that is why it's so important.
And this problem is common for young, like junior developers, but also for experienced ones, because if you're an experienced developer, you are joining, usually you will join a more complex project, and then you're again in a problem.
Yeah. One of the reasons that we walked away from focusing on junior developers only, which was our background with ITC that you mentioned and so on, was that the pain is much bigger with experienced developers, because while it's easier for them to get around in the code, the expectations from them are so much higher. So it's much, much more painful to lose a month of work of an experienced developer than it is a junior developer. Also, junior developers usually get rather simple tasks that don't require a deep knowledge of the code base anyway.
Nobody expects anything from the young people.
Yeah, well, not anything, but you know.
Just to add to Tom's point real quick, when you have junior developers coming out, you can often see a business impact from their early onboarding much sooner because they're out there fixing visible bugs and implementing visible client requests, which influence other KPIs. But that's not necessarily a task that's representative of someone that is fully onboarded. That's just someone who is able to understand the language and gather the minimum amount of information needed to address that stuff. And when in reality, the stuff that's going to have the biggest impact on the business has yet to happen because those people have yet to get to the point where they can start thinking about the stuff that they want to do.
By the way, did you try to ask developers themselves, not the manager? Because the perspective can differ.
You're right. It's mostly the same. So they also start by saying it took me this and that weeks until I started producing things. And when we asked them, how much time did it take when you felt comfortable that you could deliver, as close to your maximum capability, considering how well you knew the code base, then they said similar numbers.
Yeah, I would tell myself half a year on pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Did you find the metric?
A metric to measure that without like a hunch and so on? Not yet. There are some academic research papers about stuff like that. It's a far less complicated question than actually understanding how effective a specific developer is, though. Because measuring developer effectivity might never be possible, but understanding how far someone is in their onboarding process is less complicated because you're only trying to compare them to themselves, right? You're trying to figure out how effective they were compared to how effective they were a month ago and 6 months ago and so on. And if you can find an asymptote, right? If you can find that this levels out, then you realize, okay, they've reached not their full potential, but most of it, so they're ramped up.
Yeah, but when you're talking about asymptote, you're drawing a y-axis, and then we are back to the original question, how do you measure this y-axis? So that's right. I suppose that's why you said, okay, let's solve a more measurable problem of documentation, because, and I have to say that everywhere in my onboarding processes that I participated in, there was no documentation. Everything was like a folklore.
Yes, that is right. That is the situation in most cases. So you either find one or two. One type of documentation you might find is very tactical documentation, like comments in the code. Or maybe you would find a very well-written code, right, that doesn't need any comments.
But there is no such code.
Yeah, but you know, some people say there is, so I don't want to fight with those people. So, but that only gives you like very specific tactical context each time, right? On the other hand, you might find documentation that is very high level, like design documents and so on, but you'd probably read those once and they don't really help you in the day-to-day. And what you don't find is documentation that's in the middle between those. Documentation that describes processes, how to do stuff actually, right? The kind of stuff that you need to ask the person next.
But you also forgot those auto-generated documentation files that only have the function names and variable names, and
those don't really serve a lot more than just looking at the code, right? Frankly.
Right. So in this case, okay. So how big is this problem? I suppose that, you know what, how do you approach it?
And we're talking about onboarding now?
No, documentation. Okay, onboarding is a very hard problem to measure. We are looking only where the street lights are on documentation.
It can be the same sort of metrics here are inferences, kind of like the way that we know about dark matter in space. We can't really see it. We can't really measure it, but we infer that it exists based on things that happen around it and the sort of footprint that it creates. And the same thing goes true with the quality of your onboarding and the quality of your documentation. You have to look at what happens when the quality of those things is high. You have early high employee satisfaction surveys shortly after joining the company. You have more deliberate surveys that they give an engineering team. Engineering managers should be doing this. How well do you trust our documentation? Would you go to our documentation or would you go to a team member? Questions like that and sort of happens. And you ask people to sort of track that kind of stuff and you do a lot of surveys. And when things are going great, then yes, the trust is high and yes, people are happy with their jobs. And when it goes down, that ultimately documentation and your onboarding is something that you want to do. It's worth pointing out that people don't onboard just once nearly anymore. In modern companies, you employ microservices and container orchestration. And for every microservice, there's a whole team that's doing something completely different than everybody else is doing. That's the whole point of being able to have microservices. And so for you to be able to really ramp up, if the thing that you're working on travels through five or six of these services and interacts with the infrastructure in any way, there's a lot that you need to be able to consume. And that could be the case if you've been there for 3 months or 3 years. If you change teams or the business strategy changes, you go back to day one of really not knowing what you're doing. So that's why these surveys can really churn that stuff up. But there's no good deliberate tactical measurement unless you're doing something very, very, very deliberate in your CI and other ways to track your coverage and things like that, so you have harder numbers to relate.
So, but if there's one thing that I know about surveys, and I analyzed some of them, and I participate in a lot of them, is that it's hard to really trust the service, because when you ask a developer, are you satisfied with the code? So one developer will read it, are you satisfied with your code that you write? And then another one will answer, are you satisfied with the code that my teammate writes? So do you have or do you know of any measurable metrics that you can actually measure and not ask people?
So we've been playing with concepts about measuring coverage, like Tim mentioned. But frankly, this only becomes an issue once you're you start to think differently about documentation in the first place. Because if I come to a company and say, "Listen, you have very low documentation coverage," they're going to tell me, so tell me something I don't know, right?
Right.
So that's not an interesting statistic for them. It only becomes interesting when they decide or think that it makes sense to create that documentation. Because
no, they always think that it makes sense to make documentation, but they also know that writing code is more important. And if you have 24 hours a day, and then, well, the life is tough.
That's what I mean. I mean, it also, you know, it makes sense to do a lot of things. But what I mean by it makes
sense... Exercising and eating good food.
Yes. But what I mean is that it makes sense to do this and not write code while you're doing it. It's so valuable and effective that it makes sense to sit down and write 20 minutes of documentation instead of writing code at that time. If they don't reach that conclusion, then there's no point in those statistics in the first place. And the first thing that we're trying to do is change the basic equation about a documentation.
And you know what? Now that I talked to you guys, I suddenly realized that in all code reviews processes that I participated in, as a reviewer or as a reviewee, there was no comments about documentation whatsoever. So nobody told me this dog string isn't clear, and I never read a dog string and tried to review it.
So I think this is why it happens. Okay.
Yeah.
If you attempt to create a document that goes into details about what's going on in the code, and not only stuff, you know, that you could write in comments and so on, that's like a marriage. So you need to continue to invest in that if you want that to live on, right?
Okay.
You can't just and because the code is constantly changing. So the code change, you first need to figure out if it needs to change anything in the documentation, which is hard in itself because you don't remember everything that you wrote or someone else wrote for that matter. And then you need to find it and then you need to fix it. That's a lot of work. And for that reason, and because developers realize that they're not going to invest that time, they might as well not write that document in the first place. And managers understand that, and the developers themselves understand that, and that's why that kind of documentation rarely exists and rarely comes up in code review.
Also,
for those reasons,
when you study programming, nobody teaches you how to write. I mean, sometimes they will tell you, okay, you have to write your doc strings, but writing is a very tough task, especially if English is not your first language. Do you have any insights on how to address this problem of like the effort of writing?
So basically, we found that it's very hard to write when a developer is looking at a blank page. But once what we suggest people that we speak with is to start with code snippets. Put like 10 code snippets on the page that go through the process that you're trying to describe. And put those in the right order that you would approach them if you were doing this task right now or trying to understand this process right now. And after you do that, go snippet by snippet and describe what's going on there. From something that's daunting, a daunting task that seems impossible to some people, not Tim because he's a wizard with words, but most developers, it becomes a much, much simpler task.
You can also bring the breadth of what needs to be written can often overwhelm people and they have a hard time prioritizing what to start with. I think they'd be okay if they could just sort of figure out where to dive in. It's like a giant plate of, you know, food that, you know, you just have no idea where you're going to start. And, with that, you should always go by, you know, answer the prominent hot questions first. What are you interrupted with every day to tell someone about or, help someone understand and get that covered. And you can sit down and you can just open your notebook or you can open a text file. And you can write down three goals. And I want to write down how to make something configurable in the programmer. I want to write down how to create a new module for the API or something like that. And then go with the snippets as Tom started. Turn that into like a scaffolding for you. And then as your words start appearing above the code, you start to get momentum. You start to get forward motion that's hard to stop. And the next thing you know, you're jumping in there and you're writing and you're breaking long sentences down into shorter ones and that sort of stuff. So it's also great. The other thing that's really critical is we need to encourage a culture of documentarians within companies. And this is especially true when you have teammates that aren't as great as others with expressing things in English. And let's be frank, English is a really weird language. If you look at its idiosyncrasies, and people have to feel confident that they can get the main information out and their teammates will be there to put, you know, to help, you know, bring it up from there. And a culture of editing, a culture of improving it. So it's not just one person's job. When that gets checked in, if you can go and copy edit that, do that and have a culture in your company that encourages people to do it.
So I have two tips. One tip is that I read, I think it was Jeff Atwood, one of the co-founders of Stack Overflow, who wrote in his blog that he recommends not even recommends. He demands every programmer to learn touch typing, because when you type and you have to look for the keys, it takes a lot of effort and you become lazy. So after reading that, I learned how to touch type, and I mean it just improved my life tremendously. And another tip from me is that you should just buy Grammarly subscription, especially for people whose English is not first language. It's a miracle. I mean, I never write more than 3 sentences in English without Grammarly. It improves my writing skills. It catches a lot of awkward mistakes, and it just improves the style. So yeah, go by
Boris. Grammarly. Don't tell Tom, but a big reason why he thinks I'm such a good writer is because of Grammarly. But don't let him know that.
Yeah.
this is also true. We're getting into. I've been remote myself for almost 20 years. I can't imagine what it's like to go to an office most days. In fact, I don't know how some people do it. But that means when you're remote first, or you're hybrid, or whatever they're calling it, you're communicating. Your line of communication between you and your coworkers, and the energy that you need to build to be creative, is all done through typing. So that's definitely I think we're all getting better at it as we're forced to write instead of speak at a majority of our days at work now. And I think that's mm-hmm. one of the silver linings of this whole pandemic thing, is people got better at learning how to communicate with each other.
I think I realize Boris, that maybe people that wanted to get tips on onboarding are getting frustrated because we're talking about documentation, and they're probably thinking, but documentation doesn't really work. So so what do we do? So I just want to say that it's apparent that we're true believers in documentation, and obviously we're dealing with it because we think we found the solution to make it make sense. But it's worth noting that it's not entirely that, right? You can have great documentation, and that won't, it's not like that's enough to create a great onboarding experience for new developers. A lot of other stuff that you should do. And
like what?
So I'll start with what not to do. The research we did before Swim that I mentioned, we asked people, how does your onboarding process go? And the most of the answers were something like, we throw them in the deep end and they either sink or swim, which is also why we decided to call our company Swim. And that might be funny, but it's pretty tragic. This is also something that I know from, the military and there are actually parents who throw their kids in the pool in the deep end. But generally speaking, it's an effective method in that some of the people learn how to swim at some point. So mm-hmm. it gets results. And I think a lot of people went through that as younger people. So they have this like belief that that's the only way to learn, because if it isn't the only way to learn, so why did I have to go through that? That was a terrible experience. So I rather believe that it's the only way to go, right? And they end up being managers who think that's the way to go, that we should throw them in the deep end and then we'll know who's weak and who's strong. But actually, I believe that's a terrible, terrible methodology. I mean, there might be organizations where that works well, but I'm not saying it's always terrible, but I think it's mostly terrible, and people go to that method when they don't know about any alternatives. It ruins the first impression of the company.
Do you have, so you're talking about your impression, like your feeling. It's just as valid as the other feeling. So at this point, I have to ask you, do you have any concrete data or research that supports your feeling?
So we don't have like an academic research paper about it, but we do have hundreds of hours of discussing this with people that went through onboarding processes, either junior or senior developers. And they're pretty frustrated about this until they get to the point where they're senior and they start thinking it's the only way to go, like I mentioned before, right? But there are a bunch of things here. First of all, there's a lot of lost time. You get into an organization where you're constantly told that you have to be as effective as possible and not waste your time on irrelevant stuff. But when you're thrown into the deep end, a lot of what you're doing is looking for stuff that the person next to you would probably help you to find in a second. And then
you can ask that person, but then that person doesn't work.
Either he doesn't work, and sometimes you're not the kind of person that feels comfortable asking those kind of questions, right? Or asking them a lot, and that's a terrible feeling. So there's a lot of lost time here, either yours or the person that needs to guide you. Another thing is that this is like kind of a test, because some people will just drown. But is it the right test? I mean, the second year you're working, it's not like you're thrown. You get thrown code that you have no idea about, and are expected to deliver within minutes. That's not how things work out usually. You feel far more comfortable later on. If someone doesn't pass through that initial phase, being thrown into the deep end, that doesn't mean they won't. They wouldn't have become a great developer. So you're throwing out a bunch of people that could have been great. And the last thing is what we call the dog paddle. So the worst case scenario of throwing someone into deep end is that they just barely make it. And what you end up with is someone who is constantly with their head just above the water level, being mediocre. Just coping with it, and they're not bad enough that you fire them, but they're not as good as they could be.
So basically, it's what you are saying is that a good onboarding process is also good for maybe psychological diversity.
Absolutely.
And psychological safety.
Absolutely.
And good. Yeah, and also good for your results, right? Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. the opposite of a good onboarding.
You have to consider
process.
That onboarding is a technical and psychological process at the same time. And you're taking someone that is they're at a vulnerable point in their career, and everything is new to them. That makes you different than you would normally be in the way that you interact with other people. It's pretty well known that people that are able to quickly find and bond and identify with peers at a company early on in their onboarding group tend to do very well, as opposed to people that can't immediately identify peers, because it's that same thing. If you could, that 2 hours of searching could have been completely obviated by just asking the person next to you if they had already figured it out. And for some people, they're just reticent to ask because they just don't know how to. They don't know how to approach people. And they're especially on edge because everything is new to them. I mean, they even came to work a different way that day, and they're going to go home a different way that day. All of this stuff is weighing on them as they're trying to do this. So it definitely has to be done in a way that takes that into account and realizes that people won't do sort of the obvious choice, which is, well, they can just ask the person next to them. That's not always ever going to happen. It's going to depend on how the interactions are set up. And there's so much other stuff into it that goes into play that's not really directly measurable, but it's there. And I think one of the reasons why we don't have all these research papers and all this hard data on it is because it's a problem that isn't being looked at seriously enough. And it's one of the reasons why I love to talk about it.
Yeah, so they call it soft skills for a reason, because they're soft, not because they are not important, but it's very fuzzy to measure.
We've all, as developers, had imposter syndrome, which is you believe for a minute something doesn't go very well that you're working on. You're not immediately sure how to solve the problem that you're working on. Anxiety creeps in, and you start undervaluing your skills for that. And in an environment where you're already extremely vulnerable and nervous because you're just onboarding, you're trying to learn, And things that are very obvious to senior people, but not written down anywhere, don't seem very obvious to you. You start to believe that you are the culprit. As developers, we love to blame ourselves. If something breaks on Google, we say, oh my goodness, I just broke Google. Only later do we say, yeah, you know, someone pushed a breaking change to production at Google. But, you know, immediately we sort of want to fault ourselves for not being able to do something that we think should be perfectly obvious. And it doesn't occur to us that there was something there that could have, you know, really helped us had we known.
Except sometimes we do break things. I broke twice WordPress.com. And but everybody was cool about that, so
you should put that on a t-shirt.
I broke Stack Overflow once, yeah. And only once. I won't talk about what happened after that and why it's only once.
So some companies have this concept of mentor. So when a new employee comes in, and we already talked about the fact that onboarding doesn't have to be for a new employee, but let's say a new employee comes in and they assign the mentor for them. And in theory, that mentor is supposed to provide the software onboarding and software entrance. But I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, but from my experience, most of the times those mentors are meant to give you some introduction to internal politics and culture. And most of the times they're not from your specific field of expertise. So if you're a developer, you might have a mentor who is a QA engineer, which is not the same. Do you have any insights on that?
The main insight is that this is sometimes a decision that is made to have like a buddy system or a mentor system. And managers feel like, okay, we did that. So we took care of our onboarding. We have a system.
Yep. Done.
But actually, a lot of mentors do very poorly in their jobs, and not because they're not good people with good intentions, but because this wasn't planned out, and they're not given the resources to succeed in their jobs. And what you just said is a good example. I mean, you could use, you know, people from a different group, you know, to tell you about stuff. But there's a lot of stuff you're only going to learn by someone that knows how to get around the office, the people, and the code to be successful. And a lot of mentors lack several things. So the first one is documentation, but we already covered that. Possibly the most important one is time. So we've heard a lot of stories about people being having a buddy, and that buddy talk with them like twice in 2 months for you know 30 minutes. And again, not because they're bad people or because they don't understand their responsibility. It's just that other things are in so much higher priority, and their managers are, you know, don't look at this as an important assignment that they got, even though it's very important to the success of the company. Another thing is a plan. People often try to wing it when, you know, being mentors, but you know, actually it's something you need to plan for. You should create a very clear plan of the kind of stuff that you need to explain, how to explain it, kind of experiences that you can both you go through together, and so on.
But you know, a plan is usually covered by like a tick list. And you do V, and I think it's maybe it's not a plan, but more an issue of training. You're because right. I served as a mentor twice, and nobody trained me to this. So maybe right. I had a tick list.
You're right. Most mentors lack mentorship skills, which is it sounds funny, but that's the case. You know, I think specifically in Israel, we have a lot of people that went through commander training training in being trainers. So you get a lot of those. And when you see someone that had experience in this, you see the vast difference between those people and how well they're mentoring their new hires than the rest. So some people are just never going to be good mentors and should not be picked as ones. They could be awesome developers, but should not be buddies in the buddy system because, you know, they're not going to do a good job no matter how well they're trained. And others just lack the skills and can be taught. And the last thing I want to say is that they need passion for it, at least on some level. If this is something that they're not at least a bit passionate about, it doesn't even matter if they have a plan, they have time, they have good documentation, yeah, good mentorship skills, they're not going to invest in it. And it's not going to feel like they really care.
By the way, I now recall that Tim's official job description is a developer relationship, right? So this is what you're talking. Is this what you're talking about? Like talking to developers inside the company and making sure that they're okay?
Sometimes I do that, and other times, but
I mean, not okay psychological, but they have all the means to do a good job.
Part of the part of what you get with SWIM is you get tools that help sort of uplift the knowledge culture within an organization. Once you start using SWIM and you start seeing the value in it, and people become more enthused about documentation and finding ways to avoid it, you see a culture shift within the organization as well. So yes, part of my job is there to help people figure out how to be the champions for the documentation, that keep pushing to keep it up to date. I help people. Sometimes I'll just need to sit with a developer and talk with them and just say, look, let me help you craft the value proposition so that you can hit the least amount of friction when you propose this new documentation scheme. And that would be something that I'd be very happy to do and help them to do. So part of it is, yes, I do bring some of what are often called soft skills. But in fact, when we say soft skills, what we really mean to say is just empathy. The be able to understand the frame of mind and emotional state of someone else, and employing that is also a key part of what I think a mentor should be able to do. They not only need to have the time, they not only need to have the skill, they not only need to have the tools, which in this case is the right kind of documentation organized in a way that is conducive to onboarding it at different paces, because no one does it at the same pace. And they have to be able to empathize with the onboardee and put themselves in their place and figure out, okay, what questions isn't this person asking me because they just don't want to speak up, so that I can make sure that they, you know, have the right kind of documentation. Teaching that stuff and getting that word out there more in general, not really directed at specific developers and specific companies, but just for developers to be able to consume themselves and figure out how they want to adjust their strategy for improving documentation is a big part of what I'm doing right now, just in writing and videos and stuff like that.
One reason for some people who go into programming is that they're introverts. They prefer not to talk to people. They don't like to be empathetic. Maybe they can, but they don't like it. Maybe they would like, but they cannot do this. And then there are some, I saw several teams that are composed of very talented engineers, but none of them is a good communicator. And then how do you bridge that gap? Because they need to communicate one with another, which is not always a good and easy task. And also onboarding, right? So if somebody joins the team, it is super hard. Is there a way to mitigate those problems?
You should be looking for in your engineering managers and your principal developers and people that are generally in the leadership sort of role. You should be looking at that that skill, which is empathy. Because what they need to be able to do is they need to be able to understand the concerns of the people around them that aren't very good at vocalizing them and who tend to stay really, really quiet during change and speak up only when it's just so terrible and they just can't work with it anymore. And then, everyone is, amazed because this person hadn't said anything previously. Those people in leadership positions need to be anticipating those concerns and bringing them to the table in advance to help communicate for people that don't do it well naturally. They also need to be available to have conversations with folks that where you can talk about this sort of stuff. Getting back to surveys a little bit and satisfaction surveys, they Survey writing is definitely a skill. And if you write a survey, even if it's just five questions, you want to have at least 15 people from various backgrounds take a look at it to make sure that they all understand the questions the same, because it can get very crazy very fast when you start asking them the wrong way. Stack Overflow found out about this when they launched their first and second developer survey, and everyone read the questions a little bit differently, and the data was therefore a little bit strange to some folks. But getting people's overall satisfaction on a pretty regular basis with, I feel that, my manager knows, what my needs are, and that those are being communicated to people that, make decisions in the company, should be pretty high there. And if it's not, then there's a good chance that, folks are treating, silence as golden, and, problems are going undetected. So if that answers your question, I think a bit more.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't cover all the things about the soft skills and empathy, but yeah, you can do a nice 2-semester course on this topic and not cover all of it. But the problem is that we have, our time is up. I ask my participants to give one advice. It has to be very short, but very practical. I call this this part while standing on one foot. So it has to be very short. Now we will have two pieces of advice. Let's start with Tim.
Always read back questions as you've understood them to make sure that that's actually what the person was asking.
Always read what?
Relay back the question. If you ever asked a question, always relay it back to the person to make sure that you heard it the way that they intended it, so that you're not answering a completely different question.
But this is a way to change the question. So if you ask me a hard question, I can always say, "Well, did you mean this and that?" And then, yeah.
I've ever learned from dealing with thousands of developers at one time, it's sometimes you just what people write isn't necessarily what they mean. So always say it back if you think that there's any controversy.
Yeah, there's also the five whys. Mm. So when you hear a question, you should also ask, why is this question important and why is that question important, until you get to the root cause, right? Tom, what about you? It's your turn.
So since we've been talking about empathy a lot and mentorship, what I like to say to mostly to people that are not introverts, extroverts like myself, is that when you're in a conversation with someone, try to speak less and don't cut off awkward silences. Because if you let the other person cut off an awkward silence, you're going to get more information and you're going to understand them better.
That's for sure, but it's so hard for me. I mean, I
can no, also you've got to edit this later.
It's flexing a muscle.
So.
Thank you very much, guys. It was a pleasure. I learned a lot. I hope that all my listeners learned a lot. And I will see you around. Bye-bye.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
הרשמו להסקט בספוטיפיי, אפל מיוזיק, גוגל פודקאסט וכל פלטפורמת הסקטים אחרת. הצטרפו לדיון בפייסבוק בעמוד רעיון עבודה. עורך ומגיש דוקטור בוריס גורליק, חוקר נתונים ויועץ בתחום הדאטה. נשתמע בפרק הבא.